Hello, and welcome to Thank the Academy, the podcast where we talk about every Academy Award-winning Best Picture in order. This is the Academy Archives, and this week we're discussing Academy Award-winning film Places in the Heart, and Academy Award-winning actress Sally Field. We're your hosts, Zach and Kristen, and that's our producer, Kayla.
Hello.
Hello.
We're here talking about some more stuff from 1984.
Yeah, the year of the 57th Academy Awards.
Huzzah.
Huzzah.
It's weird because I feel like we just recorded an archives episode. I'm like, we're already recording another one? But when you don't do it for so long, it feels like you just do them back to back to back to back.
I mean, this is what we did for 2 years
prior. I know, it's hard to believe. But here we are, bringing you a new episode right away.
Yeah, like we said we would, so... Yeah.
Just getting back into the swing of it. So many big things to talk about for the rest of this 57th Academy Award year. So we've picked some fun topics to bring you.
Yeah, if you remember from our ceremony episode most recently, we talked about how there are a lot of films that came out this year that are pretty big films, very definitive of 80s culture and even just like the modern style of films that are going to become Academy Award winning films.
Mm-hmm. But it is interesting, in watching Places in the Heart, which I will get into soon, it was just interesting because it is what would have won only a couple of years prior to this. But we're already coming out of the like family drama style and moving into, like we were saying in the main episode, like the more epics, more like period pieces, more big, huge production like an Amadeus.
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing I had mentioned in our ceremony episode is that this year, all the Best Picture nominees were period pieces. So yeah, moving out of the like contemporary 80s family drama and into this like far more, you know, yeah, epic, like you said.
But before we get too far into it, let's discuss a Bosley review.
All right.
This week, Bosley is reviewing Frankenweenie.
Oh, when did that come out?
In 1984.
Wow, I didn't even
realize. The original Frankenweenie.
Wow. Aw.
So Tim Burton, of course, worked for Walt Disney. He was a big animator in the 70s and 80s era of Disney. He is partly responsible, in a way, for why some of those movies are as dark as they are. There was a group of animators like him who, I don't know, just had more dark senses of humor, more dark takes on reality and things like that. He did a ton of the character work for The Black Cauldron.
Ooh, I see.
Which is also part of why some of those characters are a little more strange looking,
yeah,
a little more sinister.
Okay.
So he wanted to make this short film through Disney. He was a Disney employee. And so he was making this short film of Frankenweenie based on Frankenstein and all of that. We kind of know the story. It's basically this dog who dies and the boy is really sad. The boy is Frankenstein. He brings his dog back to life.
Very cute and very morbid.
So it is first a live action short film. So that is the first iteration of Tim Burton's Frankenweenie.
Oh,
of course, nowadays
know
we know it as like Tim Burton's animated film Frankenweenie.
That's what I thought you were talking about. I was like, why are you talking about that now? We've got like 20 years before that's going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay.
So this is the first iteration of it. It was supposed to be released with like a summer re-release of like The Jungle Book or something.
Yeah.
The way that recently in this era they had released Mickey's Christmas Carol with re-releases. So like that's how those Disney shorts played in theaters.
Well, yeah, and that's been a tradition. Obviously, we haven't talked about it, but for going all the way back is
right
to play the short films in the theaters before watching a feature-length film.
Mm-hmm. So this was one of those Disney features that was a short film that was going to play with some of their other films. So he made this and produced it. Unfortunately, Disney did not like this.
What?
It was made to be for too much of an older audience than their like normal kids' fare.
So it didn't really, it wasn't compatible with the movie it was going to show with.
Right. And so much so that this is around the time where, and one of the things that ended up getting him fired from Disney.
Ah.
He was just going in a direction that was like not in line with their,
yeah,
our family Disney films are only for family and children and stuff.
Yeah, I can see that.
And there was a wing of Disney, like we mentioned, that was getting to be older. That's why they started Touchstone Pictures.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Really Splash, because mm-hmm. that's not really a kid's film, but Disney has other stuff that they want to make.
Yeah.
But they just didn't see eye to eye anymore. And this film was not what they wanted him to make. And he got fired. But
what does Bosley have to say about all this?
Bosley really loves Sparky, who plays himself, Sparky, in this movie.
What a cute dog name. Sparky.
Yeah, he is just a very cute bull terrier.
Cute.
Like you would imagine. This Frankenstein-esque dog. He's wearing the bolts on his neck so that he can be sparked up. And Bosley thinks that he did a great job.
Oh, yeah?
He thinks that he had a great owner who loved him very much, and he very much deserved to come back to life to be with him.
He liked the plot line of the story, huh?
He did. He
I
liked
see.
It a lot. So Bosley gives this a bark, bark, and a good rise from the dead.
Oh, wow. Is that going to be his Halloween costume this year?
Oh, that would be a fun one.
Yeah, he would look good.
Yeah. So that's the story of Frankenweenie.
Yeah, the 80s were a dark time for Disney on multiple fronts, but this only contributed.
Of course, then this is when Tim Burton really gets to like have his breakout because
he gets
to be his own filmmaker. He gets to go do what he wants to do, which is a very unique style.
Yeah. And also it's a good thing to be let go from a company for creative differences because, yeah, you're going to crush your own creativity trying to mold into what the company wants you to be. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have what we have today if he had stayed there.
And you can see in some of his work how he would align with Disney in
Absolutely.
Some ways.
Absolutely.
But then he wants to do what he wants to do too.
Well, and that's why he comes back for distribution at points,
yeah.
You know? Absolutely. That's a whole different podcast though. Eventually we'll do this whole podcast again and it'll just be like the Disney company or Warner Brothers company. Or...
yeah. So thanks, Bosley.
Thanks, Bos.
Well, shall we get to our topics?
Yeah. Great. So why don't you kick us off with the film you're talking about today, Places in the Heart?
Yes. So I didn't know what I wanted to talk about this week. And this is this film kind of jumped out at me the most because it's one of the films that like the style is what we have talked about the most.
Yeah. We had an interesting discussion this week about the narrative of this podcast
and
what that means for these episodes because you had watched Temple of Doom.
Yes. Which also, I mean, I've talked a lot about George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. And
so
there's tons of stuff to talk about that. Of course, that film won an award for
special effects.
So
also, since we're talking about this, horrible movie.
Oh, man, it's so good.
We have very different opinions about this movie.
I just loved rewatching Temple of Doom. Every moment I was like, oh, yeah, this is why I love this movie.
For
it's
those
just
of
so
you
good.
Who don't know, Zach was a weird kid who liked the weird stuff.
Hey.
And so Temple of Doom has a little boy, obviously, who is so cute. So Zach sees the adventure boy.
Key is just... I love also, like... watching it now, knowing him as an adult.
Yeah, that's
and just
sweet.
Like how special this movie was to him.
Yeah.
And it's just so fun watching him and like, Indy, you're my best friend.
And admittedly, it's so precious. But it is a horrifyingly horrible movie and you just love that weird stuff.
Yeah,
so
it's just so fun.
That's the kind of guy you are.
Yeah.
Difference of opinion.
But
also, I had thought maybe my thought was to talk about The Killing Fields this year because that's something I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you've settled on Places in the Heart and tell us why you're thinking that.
I mean, I'm really glad that I watched it. It turned out to be like I didn't know too much about this movie.
Yeah.
Other than that Sally Field was in it.
And wins Best Actress for
it. Yeah. And other than that, I didn't know anything about it. It turned out to be a really amazing film. It's set in the 30s. It is a lot about race relations in the South.
Oh, okay.
Which is not something I knew going into the film. But that's also something that we've talked about a lot with some of these films that
sure.
we've talked about with Sidney Poitier and The Defiant Ones.
Yeah.
And it's a theme that has come up many times with the Academy too, mm-hmm. because they have their own tricky relationship with race and all of that. Interestingly, it also happened in this year when Hang S-Noor wins and becomes the first Asian man to win a Best Supporting Actor award. Yeah.
And first Cambodian person to win anything Cambodian, ever.
Yeah. I will say that I was shocked after watching this that Danny Glover was not nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Oh, okay.
Because John Malkovich is nominated for Best Supporting Actor for a much smaller role.
Huh.
And he plays a blind man in the movie. And it's a very great portrayal of a person with blindness, and he's great in the film. Mm. That character is modeled off of the director's grandfather. So there's a lot of personal
intimacy there.
Yeah. With the director. But it's just crazy to me that Danny Glover was not nominated for this film.
Okay.
I feel like he could have even won the award for this role. But I mean, it's great that they're diversifying and giving it to Hang S-Noor. And I'm sure he was very deserving of the win.
Yeah, because we did not watch The Killing Fields in preparation for this episode. So can't comment on that.
Anyways, I'm glad that I watched this movie. If you haven't seen this movie, you really, really need to watch it. It's great. I think more than anything, I was just shocked at how honest the film was.
Hmm.
It's just very blatant about everything that's in the film. And it's written by and directed by Robert Benton, who grew up in the town that it's set in.
Oh, okay.
And it's set in like only a couple years after he was born in this town.
Oh, wow.
So it's all based in reality for the most part.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So let me give a little recap for those who don't know about the movie. After her husband is accidentally killed by a young drunk black boy, Edna Spalding must figure out how to keep hold of her house and children in the middle of the Great Depression in Waxahachie, Texas. She enlists the help of Mose, a black man on the run, who convinces her she can use her land for cotton to save her farm, and Mr. Will, a veteran who lost his sight in World War I, whose family has grown tired of him. The unlikely trio makes it through their collective hard times, bringing in the first yield of cotton for the region and making enough money to get through the season.
Oh, well, it sounds like things we love. An unlikely band of misfits.
Yeah.
You know, people who are underdogs trying to survive.
And it makes sense watching this film for John Malkovich to do also, because this is the era when he ends up eventually playing Tom in The Glass Menagerie.
Mm.
He also does the next best version of Mice and Men, where he plays Lenny. So it's another character like that he's getting to play as well.
Yeah.
A very put upon character whose family does not want him because he's blind and he doesn't add anything of value to their life.
Mm.
And they kind of pawn him off on this woman who needs help in a way. So he becomes... He rents a room in her house, basically.
I see. Wow.
And he's a very down on his luck character who's like, I want nothing to do with anybody, so just leave me alone. He makes chairs, so he's going to just make his chairs and his brooms and wants to be left alone, basically.
Mm.
So a great character for him to play. And Sally Field, of course, is so fun in this movie. She's great. She does exactly the Sally Field thing that you think she's going to do. And then, of course, Danny Glover is amazing. And the movie starts off right off the top. Like, the first scene, essentially, is her husband is a local sheriff. He's going to see what this black boy is doing. And he's on the train track shooting a gun because he's drunk. And he knows her husband.
Okay.
And he's approaching him in a friendly way, being like, hey, come on over here. Like, stop shooting that gun. And then he accidentally shoots him.
I see.
And you can tell that he's immediately regretful, but he's drunk, so he doesn't really know what he's doing.
Mm.
Unfortunately, of course, because this is the 1930s in the South, the boy is then drugged behind the back of a car and lynched in the movie.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's just very honest about all of that. Like,
wow. Yeah, that's brutal. I don't know.
And it's just showing everything...
As it is
in Texas.
Wow.
And I'm sure that's what Robert Benton went through growing up in the 30s in Texas.
Yeah. Well, and what a powerful thing to be able to bring to light and be a witness to what happened.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that is very strong about that and not being afraid to shy away from those dark elements of both where you came from and what you saw and what went on with the people you knew and loved around you.
Mm-hmm. And of course, it's a big deal then when Mose shows up and he's a black man and he's just looking for work. He wants to support himself, and he sees that this single woman is trying to run this house and this farm and needs a lot of help.
Yeah.
And she has this in the back of her mind that her husband was killed by a black person, and this is a big deal in white rural Texas.
Yeah. Wow.
But he plays the character so well. He it's a very emotional movie for him.
Why do you think he didn't get nominated?
Prejudice. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That has to be.
I mean, it's interesting because I can imagine, like other movies with Sidney Poitier, he wants to tell this story honestly, but he also doesn't want to have to play this kind of role.
Well, he doesn't want to be, a stereotype or anything like that. He's trying to rise above. And interesting. I wonder what the public perception of this role and his performance was at the time.
I mean, it's very, very positive. The movie went on to like great critical acclaim. I mean, it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards.
But what I mean is, like, when we think of Sidney Poitier in these roles, we think of him with great dignity and respect. And
I mean, Danny Glover was seen as that as well.
Okay. That's what I'm asking, I guess.
He
is
sort of the next actor. He didn't get the same critical acclaim as Sidney Poitier or Denzel Washington does, because they're kind of the two that are separated as far as, like, Sidney Poitier was one generation, Denzel Washington is the next generation.
Well, every generation can only have one respectable.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are other people in throughout this history who are the same. If there were allowed to be more than one, I mean, we would have, like, James Earl Jones is one of the other actors who is a huge activist. He is going through his career playing these characters. Insanely talented. Danny Glover is another one. A little bit more about Robert Benton. We started talking about him back when we talked about Bonnie and Clyde. He wrote that film.
Oh,
he co-wrote
that
with David Newman.
Okay.
That got them their first nomination for Best Story and Screenplay. Then into the 70s, he kept writing and turned to directing at the suggestion of producer Stanley Jaffe, who was then the president of Paramount. His next, like, sort of hit film writing and directing was The Late Show, for which he got an Oscar nomination. Then he co-wrote Superman also.
Oh.
And then, of course, came Kramer versus Kramer.
Okay.
That got him his first Oscar wins for both directing and screenplay. Then, of course, Best Picture. Then he made a second film with Meryl Streep called Still of the Night, which was kind of a disappointment. And then Places in the Heart was next.
Okay. He has such a sensitivity about him. That's why I think, or in those films, at least the more recent films, which is why I think I didn't realize Bonnie and Clyde was in the mix.
Yes. and then, of course, Nestor Almendros, who shot Kramer versus Kramer as the cinematographer, also shot this movie.
Oh, wow.
So it had a very similar feel of, like, I mean, part of what we talked about with his shooting of Kramer versus Kramer was how small town he made New York feel. So, of course, he makes small town Texas feel like perfectly small town.
Wow.
Another, like, major set piece of this movie is this massive tornado that takes place and basically levels the whole town. An amazing sequence. I don't really know how they did it and pulled that off, but it was crazy. Very, very good. But that was, like, a major event in Robert Benton's life as well, like the tornadoes in Texas. And so, of course, he included that. I just wanted to highlight a couple other things about Danny Glover. Black film critic Armand White, who wrote and still writes, I think, for the National Review, he cites 1984, Danny Glover, and Places in the Heart all as a very pivotal turning point for black actors in Hollywood. Like, a start of the next chapter again.
Okay.
That allow people like Spike Lee and Denzel Washington to break out more.
Okay, cool.
Just as, like, beginning the next wave of, like, also in 1984, of course, is when Eddie Murphy really breaks onto the scene.
Because
he stars in Beverly Hills Cop.
Gotcha. Totally different style and genre, but also another prominent actor.
And like I was saying, Danny Glover talks about this film like I listened to an interview between Armand White and Danny Glover. It's very, very fascinating. If you just Google Armand White, Danny Glover interview, it's like an hour and a half long, but it's well worth listening to. They just go through Danny. It's like a retrospective of Danny Glover's career. And I think it was in 1992 they had this interview. So not very much of his career up to this point, basically. But they talk a lot about this film and talk about being a black actor working for white directors. And that part of the conversation is very, very interesting because he talks a lot about how they're wondering if where it comes from that he that the white directors are a like which white directors can direct him well. Basically,
interesting.
Is it because of their guilt? Is it because of their like interest in black stuff? Is it because they knew a black person, or what about that?
Wow.
And he was saying a lot of the white directors that he liked working with the most were people who just were people who loved people and had a lot of compassion, and they just understood and were secure in their own self that they didn't feel he was like getting in the way of anything by bringing himself to the role.
Wow.
And so he had a big background in the San Francisco improv scene, like in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
So he said a lot of this movie, he ended up improvising a lot so that he could make it more real and more himself. He said that the movie and the role, he really tried to make a tribute to his grandfather, who was a farmer and sharecropper, probably a lot like this man, Mose, in the 30s. And one of the things he said, he was like, you know, he's asking me to come and do this role and pick cotton. And like, he was like, you know, the relationship that we've had with cotton. And everybody who's like a mostly black audience just is like, starts laughing.
Yeah.
And it's just a fascinating, he both wants to talk about the movie and also doesn't want to talk about the movie because you can tell it's just was such an emotional experience for him. Of course, the climax of the movie at the end is that he gets attacked by the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh my gosh.
And then that is what makes him decide he needs to move on from this town and from this family. And not that they have anything to do with it, but it's just like,
he can't stay in Texas
anymore. I can't stay here anymore.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
So again, all of that, I just like couldn't believe that he wasn't nominated. It's crazy. And it's like, it's a performance that I just didn't really know about for some reason. I didn't know too much about this film.
Yeah.
And I didn't know too much about this performance, but it's a credit to everybody involved in the film.
Yeah.
Also that he got to have as much say in it that he did, and partly because he is such a good actor and such a prominent person from this era.
Yeah.
That he was able to give as much of himself as he did to this.
Yeah. Wow.
And his own history. He was the first person in his family not to be born on a farm or a plantation.
Oh my gosh. You know, as you're sharing all this, I just keep thinking how like the movie's in the 30s.
The movie's set in the 30s, in 1935.
And this is happening in 1985. So it's not even that far removed.
Yeah. It's like, like, and that's what he was saying. Like, it could be the story of his grandfather, basically.
Yeah, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's incredible and very, very emotional.
Yeah. Yes. So you definitely should watch this movie. and then also go listen to that interview. Of course, in the next like couple of years from this movie, he's going to be in The Color Purple. Which is a huge film, very important film for black history, but also film history, and one that comes with a lot of controversy.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not looking forward to that year. Oh, no.
And then a lot of shame because it becomes the film that is nominated for the most awards without any wins.
Yeah. It's literally stuck in Academy Award history.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that it will ever be displaced.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So it's a complicated time. It's very, I don't know. It's both, and you could listen from this interview, like how both of them, these men are so honest about what being a black person, specifically a black man in the arts, is like in the 80s and 90s, and how they wanted to say that so much progress had happened, but also at the same time, they couldn't really say that because there was a lot of talk about the industry and how he just had to play the game. And sometimes he had to take much lower billing than he deserved because he just wanted to get something made.
Right.
And when black people would see him, they'd be like, "You're so popular. Why weren't you the top billing on that?" Yeah. Or like when the Lethal Weapon movie came out, they had to agree that 50% of the posters had him as the top billed actor and 50% of the posters had other people as the top billed actor.
Boy.
And that was just part of the deal that they worked out so that it would be even. And like, you know,
the sheer amount of negotiating that goes into being allowed to do your art as a person of color during this time is just, and it's hard. Well, and it's, I a lot of these films we're talking about and actors we're talking about right now, it's just such a charged time in film history. Because like you were saying, there's this desire for progress and desire for change, but fear of it actually happening. And I mean, it's interesting. We haven't really talked about this too, but it's an interesting time for TV.
Yeah.
At the same, for the exact same reasons. Like a lot of the sitcoms that we know and love that are about black families are going to happen right now in film history and TV history. And it's just, it's interesting to kind of walk through it year by year.
Yeah, and Armand White pointed out that he felt like this was one of the first films where he felt like a black character had full subtext and was like, you could see behind every moment that he was a real person and Danny Glover was able to give him everything that he could.
Yeah.
And he talked about how, partly because the acting style was different in when Sidney Poitier was acting.
Sure.
But a lot of it was like very surface level. Yeah. And he couldn't go beyond just like, I'm a nice, smart man
right.
who's doing this thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he mentions, Armand White mentions that this film is like a very big turning point for that, for him as a film critic.
Yeah.
And as a black man to be able to see like a real fully formed black man in specifically in a white movie like this.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And it's even just thinking about this time period as well in terms of we've been talking about how there's like a lot of period films that are coming out.
Yeah.
And period films for people of color are no good.
No.
It means that a lot of the roles are very derogatory.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to be in a film that felt like you were still able to play a fully formed character is impressive at the time.
Yeah. Let me just go through the awards that it was nominated for and won real quick, and then we can move on to talking about Sally Field. So it was nominated for 7 awards, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress for Sally Field, which she won, huzzah, which is a deserved win. I mean, she's really great in this because, I mean, her, we didn't really talk about her story that much, but she, I mean, it's just a great story for a woman also.
Yeah.
Going through the death of her husband, trying to raise her kids.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things I'm going to talk about in my section, because I'm, spoiler alert, talking about Sally Field, is that this film was really pivotal for her because it's during an era where she's trying to break out. Well, she had broken out with Normal Ray, but like, she's really trying to like maintain her game. And a lot of the films that are coming out are just so male dominant.
Yeah.
She cannot break in with the boys club. It's like one of her great grievances about this like period from 75 to 85.
Then we have Best Supporting Actor for John Malkovich. He was nominated. Best Supporting Actress for Lindsay Krause. Best Screenplay Written Directly for the Screen for Robert Benton, which he won. And Best Costume Design for Anne Roth.
Nice.
So those were the nominations and 2 wins.
Great.
Should have had 1 more nomination for Danny Glover.
And possibly one more win. But
yeah. Yeah.
Who knows?
He's considered one of the best actors to never receive a nomination.
Wow. Wow.
So shall we talk about Sally Field?
Yeah, I am extremely excited for this discussion today because Sally Field is one of my favorite actresses.
Mm-hmm.
She has always been.
Another famed leading lady.
Yeah. You know, I love the famed leading ladies, but I really love it when they have brown hair and brown eyes and were in movies that I loved as a child. I was very excited because one of the first movies that I remember ever watching on my own that like wasn't a movie my parents showed me, but like a movie that I discovered was Steel Magnolias.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I picked it out at the library and brought it home and went down the basement and watched it by myself. And holy moly, it changed my life. And so I have just loved her forever. So
yeah.
I'm very excited to talk about this
Great.
Today. But anyways, just a little bit of an overview. She has 3 Emmys, 2 Oscars, and many, many other nominations, Tony nominations, BAFTA wins nominations, Golden Globe wins and nominations, all kinds of stuff. And she's an incredibly, incredibly impressive actor. I mean, we all know this, but
yeah.
even just in terms of her career, she had led 3 sitcoms by the time she was 28.
Wow.
Like she just like jumped in and from the get go was fully, fully in. Steven Spielberg said about her, quote, oh, this is when he worked with her on Lincoln, but they became friends through that process.
Sure.
He said, quote, as an actor, she dared this town to typecast her and then simply broke through every dogmatic barrier to find her own way. Not to stardom, which I imagine she'd decry, but to great roles in films and television. Through her consistently good taste and feisty perseverance, she has survived our ever-changing culture, stood the test of time, and earned this singular place in history. She was kind of known for having a flair for portraying women who had hidden reserves of strength that were dismissed or diminished by the world around her. That was kind of like her go-to, the thing that like really was juicy for her.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Benton said about her, quote, ordinary is the most difficult thing in the world to act, but Sally knows how to be ordinary in the most heroic sense of the word without putting quotes around it. Most people get points for acting ordinary on screen, but you always see the acting underneath, not with Sally. She's just there, absolutely present and flawless, which I feel like is a really great descriptor of her style.
Yeah.
So she was born on November 6th in 1946 in Pasadena.
Oh.
She was born right here. Her mother was an actress. Her father was a military man, but they divorced, and then her mother remarried her stepfather, who's also an actor. So she had access to the industry since the time she was born.
Nice.
I will also mention that in her memoir, she does talk about her stepfather and the sexual abuse that she endured from him. So just wanted to kind of throw that out there, that even though he was an actor and everything, I don't feel like he's worth mentioning or bringing up because he caused her a lot of pain and trauma throughout her younger years. Moving right into her career, she got her start on television at age 19 in 1965 as the boy crazy surfer girl in the sitcom Gidget.
Ah, yes.
So she did this show. The show was not super successful at first. It was canceled after 1 season, but it's set in Hawaii and they're all, you know, surfers and whatever else. It's very summery. And so reruns during the summer were very popular.
Mm-hmm.
People would watch it then. So it ended up kind of having success later on. And she loved being on this show. She said about this in an interview with Variety, quote, it all started with Gidget in 1964. And that was a pivotal moment. I loved Gidget. The fantasy was so real. I had a yellow and pink bedroom and I had all these cute boys that would hang out with me.
Hmm.
She also said her mother had said to her as she started her first official acting job on this sitcom, she said, quote, don't be afraid of the camera. Go up to it. Look into the lens. Make friends with it. Invite it into your heart. The speech was such an interesting and odd thing to say, but it was true. I had to feel that the camera was coming closer to me, and that was a good thing. Come in. I'm safe with you here. I'm better with you close to me than I am when you're far away. And so this kind of became her like entry to filmmaking and how she was going to be as an actress.
Yeah.
When the show ended so quickly, ABC knew they had something on their hands with her. So they wanted to get another like show that was going to be a starring vehicle for her. So they put her in the show, The Flying Nun. She was Sister Bertrell in this for 3 seasons from 1967 to 1970. And she hated it. She said,
yeah,
she
I have
like
heard that.
Loathed this job. She said about it, quote, It was a job, and I learned to survive things. It's important to learn how to survive things. Things you like, things you don't like. I just had to put my head down and go to work and do the very best job that I could. And those are the times that you realize there's a reason why you're eating so much, but trying to hide. You're trying to cover up your depression. But at that point in my life, I didn't have any of the skills to recognize what was happening to me, and I was unable to see what my dreams were.
I mean, if you even just like seeing a clip of that show, you can probably sense that you felt pretty stupid working on it. I mean,
yeah. Well, and it's tough because this is what was happening to her. And she talks extensively, kind of the story of her life is that she did these sitcoms. And in the 60s, sitcoms were kind of a dead end for a lot of actresses. Mm-hmm. They were not a way to really have longevity in your career. And they also were not very critically acclaimed. And so she watched a lot of the women around her do these sitcoms, and people enjoy the sitcoms, but then once they end, it's over for them.
Well, and everybody was trying to find the next Lucy.
Yes, yeah. And she realized that this was going to be a dead-end street, and so she ended up a little bit later firing her agent because her agent knew she could continue doing sitcoms, and she was like, if I do one more sitcom, I will be stuck in this world forever, and I need to get out of it and do some real film. Hmm. But I'll get to that in just a second. In 1971, she did the ABC television film, Maybe I'll Come Home in the Spring, where she played a teen runaway. And she continued to do a bunch of stuff on ABC through this time. Lots of television guest appearances through the 70s. She did a show on Alias Smith and Jones, bunch of like just random things. She was opposite John Davidson in the short-lived series The Girl with Something Extra from 73 to 74. And when that series was canceled, she said, screw this. It's all over. I'm not doing another sitcom. So when she was on The Flying Nun, she did become close with Madeline Sherwood, who played Mother Superior on that. She said about this that Madeline Sherwood kind of saw something in her. That she recognized that she was a young actress with a lot of potential and took her by the hand and introduced her to this thing that actors were doing at the time, which was going to the Actors Studio. So she introduced Sally Field to Lee Strasberg. And this is where things really changed for her. Mm. She loved the Actors Studio. She loved the training. She loved Lee Strasberg, and she worked her tail off. And she also made a lot of personal and like career changes, changing her agents, like a bunch of other things where she was like, I know that they see me as a pea-brained girl next door, and I need to get out of that. I need to have grit. I need to prove that I can do drama, that I can do scene work, that I can be intimate and the camera can come close to me and I can show you the pain, you know? Mm-hmm. and very soon after she started studying with Lee Strasberg, she landed the title role in the 1976 television film, Sybil.
Right.
How should I say this? Today, looking back on this film, it is probably not a very helpful film in terms of talking about mental health issues and personality disorders. But it was an incredible challenge for her as an actress at the time because she is playing a woman with dissociative identity disorder and played a woman who had 26 identities living within her. Mm-hmm. And it is based on a book, which is based on a story, whatever. I don't want to get into it too much, although I will say that I saw this movie again. I rented it from the library and it was around similar time as, you know, this. And I was like, Sally Field is the goat. She's the person I want to be. I want to play characters like her. And this movie hasn't stood up to the test of time, but it did win her very first large award, an Emmy Award for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Special Program, Drama, or Comedy.
Huzzah.
And this was really what broke her out. Mm. People were very surprised. And it helps that she had kept to television in a way, like that it was a television movie. I think that helped the transition a little bit. But this really proved that she could actually do the acting thing because she was playing so many characters and showing so many versions of herself in such a short amount of time that were going through such deep pain. Mm. As I said, kind of while you were talking, she was up against challenges that were cultural as well, because this was a very male-dominated time. We have films like The Godfather and All the King's Men and all these movies that she wanted to do that were being led by ensembles of men.
Yeah.
And she just couldn't find a good weigh into some of that, the way that Meryl Streep had or Diane Keaton had.
And it's such a strange shift in Hollywood. And I'm not sure what prompted it, because like there was not a major event or thing that started the trend, but I guess just a shift in culture in which like in the 30s and 40s and 50s, everybody went to the movies to see women.
The glamorous starlet. Yeah.
And then once you go 60s, 70s, 80s, it's all about the
rough
hilarious
and tumble
men,
yeah,
and men being boys and action, yeah, stars. And it's just very different.
And the women who are in these films, they get a single role.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the soft, sweet, feminine girlfriend, wife, the outside eyes that are watching what the men are doing.
Who has like one scene where she can get angry. And
yeah,
that's it.
Yeah. And she usually cries at some point. And knowing Sally Field, she is just such a different type than Diane Keaton or Meryl, yeah, Streep. Like, mm-hmm, they are much different than she is. And so it makes sense to me in terms of like the style that we've seen, why she wasn't getting those roles at that time either.
Mm-hmm.
In 1977, she co-starred with Burt Reynolds, Jackie Gleason, and Jerry Reed in one of the highest grossing films of the year, Smokey and the Bandit.
Mm-hmm.
And this, I bring this up because this leads to her having a relationship with Burt Reynolds.
Oh.
So from 76 to 1980, they dated very intensely. And then from 80 to 82, they were on again, off again, on again, off again. And then finally broke up in 1982. And he was a terrible boyfriend to her. He was very jealous of her nominations for the film Norma Rae, which I'm about to talk about. He refused to go with her as her date to the Oscars.
Hmm.
He advised her not to go to the Cannes premiere, saying, you don't think you're going to win anything, do you? Of course, in 2015, he said in an interview that she was the love of his life, that he missed her terribly, didn't know why he was so stupid. He said, quote, men are like that, you know, you find the perfect person and then you do everything you can to screw it up. And in response to this in 2015, Sally Field said that she had, quote, no response, really. and that they don't really talk anymore. She did say when he passed that it was a love she would remember forever, that she would hold those memories. Which is the nicest thing you can say,
okay, great,
at someone's passing. But this also was like a big kind of turning point for her. She didn't really continue to date super famous people after this, just because it was like too touchy, you know? And this leads us, of course, to 1979, in which she plays the titular union organizer Norma Rae.
Huzzah!
Which really, really cements her as a dramatic film actress.
Mm.
Vincent Canby for the New York Times wrote, quote, Norma Rae is a seriously concerned contemporary drama illuminated by some very good performances and one Miss Fields that is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And for this, she won many, many awards, including Best Female Performance Prize at the Cannes Film Festival when it premiered and the Academy Award for Best Actress. And she talks about this time when she won this first Oscar as like being very shocking to her. She just like didn't feel accepted by the industry and by her peers at this point in her career. She felt very out of body. And like, we talked about when she won, she kind of was just like, whoa, wow. Okay, thank you. And like going back to her seat, she just like couldn't really take it in.
Yeah.
It was a little bit overwhelming to her. But she did get her second Oscar a few years later in 1984 for the film we've just talked about, Places in the Heart.
Huzzah.
And when this time it came around, she was ready. She felt so present. And of course, as I talked about in our ceremony episode, her speech has since been long remembered and parodied and rewritten and everybody quotes it.
Yeah.
She does get very annoyed that people think she said, you like me, you really like me. When in fact, that was just a parody in a commercial used years later. And what she had actually said was, I can't deny the fact that you like me. Right now, you really like me. So, you know, it's close, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
She's talking directly to her peers that she had felt isolated from for so long.
Yeah, because it's like, now in this moment, you,
yes,
like me.
Yeah. I am one of you now, finally.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's kind of sad that it takes that kind of award and recognition to feel that way. But actors are nothing if they're not insecure. When interviewed about like reflecting on this time in an interview for Variety, she said, quote, "I told myself that if this happens to me again, I must take the time to feel it because it's a hard industry. It had been a struggle because I had to work to get out of situation comedy television. It was hard. And the business can really kick the poop out of you. And it will diminish you and your talent if you don't let yourself feel the good things. Because believe me, you really feel the bad things and you take them to heart and you own them and they fester. So then I knew you have to also allow yourself to feel the glory of a good thing."
Mm.
Which is just like really powerful and really true.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to just kind of move along here. That was kind of the point that I wanted to get up to in her career, because as I've said over and over, this was what really turned her and like helped her break into the industry in the way that she wanted to be. And then she kind of had her choice of what she wanted to do. And the rest of her career is kind of up and down. Shortly after this, she did Steel Magnolias in 1989, which I didn't realize was not like an Academy Award winning film.
I mean, it's just a very classic film. It's yeah. probably, I mean, it probably just made a lot of money and has stood yeah. the test of time for that. The
In my
play
mind,
was
it
very
is.
Critically acclaimed.
Yes, yes.
More so than the movie.
Yes. So she plays Malin in Steel Magnolias. She did get nominated for a Golden Globe for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about this because it was very important to me. Specifically, there's a scene in both the play and the movie, but in the movie when she's doing this role, where Malin has like a two-page monologue talking about the death of her daughter, Shelby.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those monologues that has gone down in history as like the go-to women's monologue. It's like the range of emotions. She's going through all the stages of grief in essentially one long monologue
yeah.
with her friends standing there supporting her and loving her. And it is the tearjerker of all tearjerkers. And she said, I just wanted to like share some of the things that she has said about it. This is from an interview she did with Vulture talking only about this movie. So that's where I'm pulling this from. She said, quote, "I mean, quite obviously, it is a humdinger of a scene, but that scene was the crux of the film because it's about loss and sadness and grief and rage, but ultimately it's about friendship. It's about these women who hang with her. Every step of the journey she takes in that suite, she walks up and down the dirt road of the cemetery, and they're right there with her, feeling it with her. And ultimately, they make her laugh. And that's the very best of what women friends are." And for those of you who don't know, Robert Harling, who wrote the play and the screen adaptation, based the story on his own family and the loss of his sister. And in the interview, she was asked, like, how much did that weigh on you? Were you thinking about him and his sister and his family and making him happy and all that kind of stuff? And I wanted to bring this up because I think it speaks to her acting technique. She said, quote, "It really is not my task to have it weigh on me. I have to pay allegiance only to the text and the actors around me and the world. It is the text that I have to work with, even though Robert and I became very close and he would tell me things. I could hear that, but I had to be my own Malin. The thing with that film is, good or bad, you need to catch it once. You need to catch this little moment. So it really is about all those little things. And then, because of the way I was trained, it is most especially about where all of this links to yourself, your own rage and grief and sadness and loss and how that manifests itself." And of course, she also became very close with the cast. Those women all were very close when they made that film.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I just really, it was really hard for me to read this interview because I was getting very emotional reading it. One of the things that she mentioned was that she had just had her son fairly recently. He was 6 months old when she was making this film. And so he came to set quite a lot. And he was really transfixed with Dolly Parton, specifically her nails. He like just loved them and loved to look at them. And one of the things she talked about is when they're filming that scene, because it's such a long monologue, they did her takes a bunch of times, but then they have to get the takes of all the other actresses. And it just takes a long time.
Yeah.
And she talked a lot about how no one can sit in grief for that long.
Yeah.
It just exhausts you. And every time they would do a take, they would just sob and you run out of stamina.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes personal in a way that it's not meant to as an actor.
Right.
And so she was talking about a lot of those like things that they would do to kind of either make it fresh again or to protect themselves. And one of the things she did when it was Dolly's take was that she started to change some of the lines to her son's name, Sammy, instead of Shelby's name.
Oh, interesting.
And she said it was just an absolute weeper. They just all dissolved and they had to go lay down in the grass for a while. I want you to know I think a lot about, like, if I could go back in time and be somewhere and, like, witness something spectacular, this is going on the list of things that I wish I could have been there for.
So Walt Disney acting out Snow White.
Yeah. And then fast forward to Steel Magnolias. And that's kind of where I wanted to leave us. Of course, she has a long career. She's still alive. She's doing lots of things. Shortly after this, she did Homeward Bound, where she voices Sassy, another absolutely influential movie in my childhood. She does Mrs. Doubtfire in 93, which is one of her more beloved roles, of course.
Mm-hmm.
She's wonderful, adorable. The two of them are both adorable in that film. Shortly after this, in 94, she plays Tom Hanks' mother in Forrest Gump.
Oh, yeah.
She was only 10 years older than him.
I always forget that she's in that film, too.
Yeah. I mean, and she is not, like, with him as herself. When she's with him, she's aged up, obviously. Yeah. Like, she's his mother when he's younger. Literally everyone's seen Forrest Gump. I don't need to explain this to you.
And we're going to do a whole episode on it.
Oh, gosh. But, yeah. And so through the late 90s and the 2000s, she does a lot of TV. She kind of, like, finds a home for herself doing TV again, which was the thing she tried to escape. But now she's doing more dramas.
And it's a lot different and better and, like,
sustainable.
Yeah.
And, yeah, exactly. In 2005, she was diagnosed with osteoporosis, which led her to create Rally with Sally for bone health.
Oh, good. Good job, Sally.
She got another Emmy Award in 2007 for her role in Brothers and Sisters. Of course, in 2012 and 2014, she plays Aunt May in The Amazing Spider-Man,
mm-hmm.
revitalizing an iconic role,
mm-hmm.
An iconic actress for an iconic role. Of course, she got a lot of praise for her portrayal of Mary Todd in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, mm-hmm. which got her a Best Supporting Actress nomination at the Oscars. Also in 2017, she actually reprised her role of Amanda Wingfield in The Glass Menagerie on Broadway.
Mm.
She had done it previously at the Kennedy Center in 2004, and so they revived the same production in 2017, which is
that's quite a long time later. Yeah.
I actually, come to speak of it, I'm not totally sure if it was the same production, but she played Amanda in both versions.
Mm-hmm.
So she was nominated for a Tony for this, did not win, but got her nomination. And I kind of feel like she'll get a Tony in her life still.
Oh, really?
I feel like she could do it.
Hmm.
I believe in her.
Okay, great.
She did some television after this. In 2018, she did the miniseries Maniac. And then in 2020, she did a series called Dispatches from Elsewhere, in which I got to be with her.
Wow.
I got to sit next to her in one of the pivotal scenes, and I am sharing the screen with Sally Field. So I will absolutely post a photo of the two of us on the Instagram so you can see us. It was so fun. It was a dream come true. I was so nervous. I've never been, like, nervous to talk to famous people because I've talked to them quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh my gosh. First of all, she's so short.
Yeah.
She is so, 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 so tiny. And I'm a large person. So it was
And
quite
she's probably tinier now that she's older.
Yeah. And she has osteoporosis.
Yeah.
But she was so funny. She very clearly did not like that there were so many people there. She's definitely one of those actors who, like, has her little blinders on and, like,
right.
does her job.
Right.
So I didn't talk to her really at all, except to just, like, help her into her seat and, like, sit there and, like, make sure that everything was going well. But what an honor it was. And of course, my final note is that in 2022, she was in one of the greatest films of the year.
Oh, boy.
80 for Brady. With her four other gal pals, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, and Rita Moreno, the greats of the Hollywood industry.
Yeah.
Also, she was arrested with Jane Fonda in 2019 at a climate protest.
Great.
So that's what I have to share today about Sally Field. I can't speak highly enough about her. I just love her performances. I think her work is phenomenal.
She's great.
She's great. She's very practical. She's a no-nonsense lady,
mm-hmm.
but she's also very sweet. She loves her kids, her grandkids, her dogs, all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
An actress through and through.
Yeah.
And you know that I just love an actress that loves her training.
Mm. Well, and with that, we have come to the end of the episode, in which we like to give our thanks to the Academy for things relating to this episode, the people that we talk about, the movies we discuss. What would you like to thank the Academy for today, Kristen?
Well, first, I would like to thank the Academy for taking control of your career.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if Sally Field didn't fire her agent. Imagine if she did like one more sitcom in the late 60s, early 70s, and then was like, well, now.
Just petered out.
Yeah. We wouldn't have Steel Magnolias. We wouldn't have Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey.
I mean, those things would exist, but just with somebody else and probably
and
not
it would
be
terrible. We wouldn't have Places in the Heart or Norma Rae. Norma Rae was a huge inspiration this past year in our big union moments. Huh. So I think that is incredibly astute. And also it's one of those things that sets her apart. It's why she survived and other actresses didn't, was that she knew what she wanted and she did the brave thing of taking the risk and doing it and even pausing her own career to train.
Yes. I would like to thank the Academy for making a film about your life.
They're always the best ones.
Writing about what you know,
yep.
Grow up in this small town, just let's capture that moment and those people and make an honest film about it.
Yeah.
I meant to read this quote from Vincent Canby also in the New York Times about the film. It's a very interesting quote, knowing everything the film is about. He says, quote, "Robert Benton has made one of the best films in years about growing up American."
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting because everything in the film really does capture America. Like,
wow.
All about it. The racism, yeah. the poorness of everybody in this time in the 30s and in small town America. And
the will to survive.
Yeah.
And,
very interesting. He went on to say that it is, quote, "moving and often funny, a tonic, a revivifying experience right down to the final images."
Wow, those are some fun words. I want to thank the Academy for not thinking about your ex in years when he thinks about you every day. Just the way it should be.
Hmm.
The great love of my life lost. Oh, well, I haven't thought about him in a while.
No
good
comment,
for you.
Really. And I would like to thank the Academy for Danny Glover.
Hell yeah.
He's great. I mean, I love him. And anything I've seen him in, I like him a lot.
Yeah.
Shout out to him in Angels in the Outfield.
Oh, that's right. Zach showed me that for the first time very recently.
An equally great performance that he brought much gravitas to. So good. Of course, awards don't mean...
They mean nothing.
...that you've had a great career.
Yeah.
You can have a great career. You can do important roles.
Yeah.
You can stand out.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mean that...
Also, award systems are prejudiced.
Yes.
Deeply.
It's
against
true.
So many things.
And we've known this.
We've known this since it literally started. So... If you've learned nothing from this podcast, that's what we want you to take away with it. We've said this before, but the awards don't matter.
And with that, we tell you goodbye and then to join us next week to listen to our show about awards.
Yeah, for two people who don't believe in awards, we sure dedicate a lot of time to it.
We just like the film industry.
Yeah, it's a good lens. It's a good lens to view our history.
Yeah. All of its complications, you know, throughout the years.
Yes, sir.
But join us next week when we talk about the 58th Academy Awards and the Best Picture winner, Out of Africa.
Thank you for tuning in to Thank the Academy. You can follow us on social media at Thank the Academy Podcast on Instagram and Thank Academy Pod on X. If you enjoy listening to the show, make sure to leave a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify podcasts and subscribe on your favorite streaming platforms. The theme song was created by the one and only Noah Heisiger. Join us next week on Thank the Academy.